Yeah, so first I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting me to this wonderful workshop. And it's actually, I'm coming back to Waterloo. I was a postdoc at IQC. So today I'm going to tell you about work on issue related to AQLD state. I divided it into two parts. One is the ground state of gap Hamiltonian. And the second part is a resource for universal quantum computation. And I'm actually going to talk about the second part first and then talk about the first part later. Yeah, first, I'd like to thank a lot of collaborators, especially Robert, that he gave me into this business of measurement-based quantum computation. Also had the pleasure to talk to Ian about this. And then I also have other collaborators over the years. I'd like to point out that the work on the gap is mostly done by my fantastic graduate student, Nicole Pomata, who was actually a master's student here. So it looks like my work is really connected to here. Okay, so this is the outline. As I told you that I'm going to actually tell you about, by now it's probably history of what we did in the past few years on the AQLD as a universal resource. There's still quite a few open problems. And then I'll move on to the discussion of the gap for a few two-dimensional AQLD models. And these are some of the references. And let me just start reviewing the framework that people use in quantum computation. First is the standard circuit model, and it's a major scheme implemented by many lab and companies. The second one, which is using a slightly different approach, using the adiabatic. I should press this, get me confused. That this is my the best innovation that I have made in my slide. That you take the ground state of a simple Hamiltonian and adiabatic connected to the final ground state of the problem that you're interested in. Approach is by deep wave. The third one is using the exotic particle called anion that when you braid them, they actually give you unitary gate. But you could also regard that as a similar a way using a physical system to simulate a circuit. I would say using the exact exotic anion is approached by Microsoft. Maybe they can comment on that. And I think Google is using a hybrid approach of taking a circuit model to simulate topological. This is my way of viewing that. Or you could view it another way that Google actually is implementing a circuit version of the three-dimensional cluster state quantum computation. So this leads to me to the measurement-based model, which Robert and Akimasa and others already introduced. So the idea of this model is that we only restrict ourselves for the moment just to do local measurement. But that requires entanglement as a resource. I believe these are approach that psi quantum people are going to implement that. So
yes, it is believed.
That's my belief. So I mean, yeah. I cannot verify, but that's my belief. And let me just briefly go over the measurement-based model. Robert has discussed that, but let me just make sure we are on the same page. So the idea is if you have a circuit, this is a simplified version, that you want to perform such computation, you just cut out the circuit, the part that mimic the circuit topology by, for example, Z measurement. This is particular to the cluster state. And then if you want to do these single qubit gate, you perform local measurement along the wire. So each wire represents a logical qubit evolution. So there are three wires representing three logical qubits. And if you want to implement these control gate, you perform measurement near the bridges. And so that means we require two dimension or higher dimension in order to be universal. Okay, so So then you could ask the question, actually David and others have asked about how much entanglement is needed, and it seems that too much entanglement is probably not good, that this is the precise definition. If the so-called geometric entanglement is greater than n is the number of qubit minus a small constant, then this is probably as good as the classical coin flipping. And they also argue that actually state with high entanglement are really typical. So this means that the resource states are really rare in the Hilbert space like this. But my personal view is that this is actually a region we cannot access very well. So maybe it's okay that we can search within the space that we can get to and to find universal resources. And there's still a few open questions. Of course, the one that we're interested here is how can we have a systematic way of characterizing universal resource states? And some other question that has been brought up over the year is that these states, like cluster state, they don't necessarily arrive as ground state of two-body Hamiltonian, although they could be approximated as a ground state of two-body Hamiltonian. And we desire to have these resource states as a ground state of such local Hamiltonian. So maybe from an experimental point of view, you could actually engineer the Hamiltonian and cool the system, then you would be able to get to the resource state. Because the resource state is the most important starting point, and after that, we only do local measurement. So there are a few family of state that we've studied over the years, and just list a relevant contribution that other people that might have missed. So the first family is the Affleck Kennedy Leaf Tasaki states. In one dimension, it's not universal, but it gives us a lot of insight. And in 2D, Akimasa and we and Robert, we found that the one that actually originally devised on the honeycomb lattice is actually universal resource. So I will tell you a little bit how we show that. And so the gap of that model, we often ask, is the model gap? And we always say that it's shown that it has exponential decay correlations. So the gap, we don't really know until recently. The gap has been established, but it's not a mathematical rigorous proof. It's definitely showing that the thermodynamic limit is a non-zero gap. So this is independent by Lam, Sandvik, and Wang, and my student. So I will spend some time later to talk about this result. And the other part of the direction that we look include a symmetry protective topological state. And I think this has been covered a lot, so I will not dwell much. So if you have questions, please feel free to start. Okay, so this is the outline. So let me define what AKLT states are and what their related models. These are usually called valence bound ground state. And they were invented to provide strong support for Hodin's conjecture regarding the spectral gap of spin systems. And they now recognize, at least for the 1D case, is the example of SPD state. So they can be defined on any graph, depending on the graph, local structure, and the spin, local spin will be different. And there are unique ground state of two-body Hamiltonian like this. It's polynomial of Heisenberg interaction. So let me just show you an example of the 1D AKLT. Spin one chain is Heisenberg, but also Heisenberg square. And in 1D it has been proven right in the beginning of the AKLT paper that there's a gap. So that actually supports Hodin's conjecture that Heisenberg model has a gap for integer spin. So this is defined on any graph. So to define the AQLD state, you look at your neighbor to see, okay, now I have, for example, four neighbors for this one. I put four virtual qubits, and these virtual qubits are in the form of singlet. So that's the starting point of the AQLD. In order to project, to make it into physical subspace, you do a projection to the symmetric subspace of these qubits. For example, you project the four qubit state, Hilbert space, only to the symmetric subspace. So that gives you a spin two in this example, and three half on honeycomb lattice, and spin one on the one dimensional. But it can be defined on any graph. So the number of virtual qubits per side is the number of neighbors. And I already told you this. So physical spin is equivalent to the symmetric subspace of qubits. So you can actually view in terms of the virtual qubit to describe the state. Okay. And the Hamiltonians, the parent Hamiltonian, such that this is the ground state, is actually a sum of projectors. It's actually easy to understand because if you look at this system here, this two neighboring sides, this one is already used by singlet, so it has no contribution to total angular momentum. So you're left with a fewer number of spin that can contribute to a total number of spin. That's the sum of the two. Therefore, if you write down the projector of this, locally it would annihilate the wave function. So therefore, this is a frustration-free Hamiltonian for the AQLD state. And it also has a tensor network representation, so I can just schematically write, these are the physical indices, and all these black lines are the virtual indices. If I contract, then I get the component of a wave function. And the virtual bound dimension is actually two, so really the smallest you can get to get non-trivial quantum many-body states. So this is just a summary of AQLD state that can be useful. So we study, press the wrong button, over the years on these various different lattices, whether they can be used for measurement-based quantum computation. And those with smiley faces are those that we can definitely show that they are good for MBQC. Those with sad faces, we don't know whether we can, but we cannot establish, but we believe that probably they won't be able.
Okay, but there's no case where you have a no-go.
There's no, we don't have a quantitative no-go theorem for that, or even qualitative.
Do you have an intuition for what makes you smart?
These are because, I have intuition of what make them not smile because they have frustration. So they have triangle, local triangle here. And that actually forbids some of the measurement outcome to occur. And therefore would break the graph state to disjoint pieces. But I can tell you more later, maybe if you ask me. It's not in the, I have the backup slide for that. But let me just give example of the AQLD state on the honeycomb lattice. So each side you have three virtual qubit, and these form singlet with neighbor virtual qubit, and you have projection into symmetric subspace. So you can write down a mathematical projection. So you take, yeah, so these four states are the basis for the symmetric subspace of three qubit. The 0, 0, 1, 1, 1, and W and W bar state that we use quite often in quantum information theory. And they are mapped to the spin 3 half of four components of physicals. So I just want you to notice that this is actually an encoding, a redundant encoding of a logical qubit. So we want, in some sense, retain such a two-dimensional subspace. By making some measurement, maybe some projection we can make. So that's say that maybe we want to achieve so that there's some generalized measurement, I can achieve this action on all sides. But you know it's because of the measurement, so you can always achieve that, so there will be some leakage. But it turns out that you can write these projectors in terms of the other two bases, and happily that they sum into identity, meaning that it's complete. So meaning that you can design a POVM so that when you input the state and you perform measurement, the device or the measurement device tell you what action actually has been act on the state. So depending on the outcome. Of course, this probably would not be practical if you want to use AKLT state to do real quantum computation. So I told you that after we perform this generalized measurement on all sites, this actually gets converted to a graph state, a graph which is different from the honeycomb. So let me tell you, so I have no time to tell you the proof, that you have to trust me that we prove this. And so I'll just give you the example. Suppose this is one of the measurement outcome that we get, and this is on the honeycomb, that is on the square octagon, and different colors represent different local measurement outcome. And so the way to construct a graph is that you look at the neighboring connected side that have the same outcome, you glue them as one big domain, so it's like a antiferromagnetic domain, so they actually form one logical qubit. So ideally, I wanted to each side being a logical qubit, but because the measurement is random, I have no way to control, so I have to live with what is given, and the reason that they form only one domain is a domain only is a qubit is that because these anti-correlated relation, so they only span actually two-dimensional subspace. So then you find your vertices, and then you have to clean up the edges because essentially sigma z squared is identity in the case of control z's. Therefore, if you have more than two edges connecting to the domain, you have to clean up depending on it's even or odd. If it's even edges connecting to domain, then essentially there's no connection. If it's one or three, then it's essentially one. Okay, so that's the way we construct a graph. And these, for example, these are samples from a distribution. We can calculate that for a given random measurement outcome, we know how we can sample the probability distribution. It's actually as a nice geometric object. So V is number of domains, and E is number of inter-domain edges before you do these deletions, et cetera. Okay. So the third part, in order to establish that this is universal, is that now this become a graph state. It's a random graph. But in order to show that's universal, you have to show you have sufficient connectivity so that you can actually identify wires representing qubits and edges or bridges connecting them that allow you to do entanglement operation. So essentially what we do here is we randomly generate these and then produce a graph description, and then we test whether there's a path going from left to right in the sense of percolation. And we also try to see once we identify there is a path, we want to test how robust is this. So how do we test that? We test by randomly deleting each vertex in the graph here, the random graph here. So this is a function of the probability of deleting a site and versus the probability of whether it still has a spanning cluster. And we see that there's a phase transition. So our state without deleting is really at a deep inside a supercritical phase. And you can actually do the collapse just like what people do in STATMAG and condensed matter, that these actually belong to the transition actually belong to the universality class of 2D percolation. So we encounter some difficulty for spin 2 because naively taking this don't sum up to identity. There's also, so that means there's some possibility of leakage out of your logical space. And we also have another problem that how do we evaluate this probability distribution? We can do that on the honeycomb lattice, but after really long struggles, Robert came up with a nice lemma about that, but I won't have time to discuss it. So we actually went to a different other lattice before we get to the square lattice by looking at these decorated one or modified lattice so that the spin two sides are not next to each other. And once we understood that, we were able actually to solve the square lattice case. So in the end, we show that if you perform the similar operations, filtering out the graph state, and then these curve under the deletion, purposeful deletion, that actually they all collapse. So establishing that there's a phase transition. So therefore, the AQD state, from AQD state, you can generate graph state that are deep inside this supercritical phase of the population. So the emergent picture that we have about universality of the AQD family is as follows. So we can only deal up to spin two. So if you have any spin one half, spin one, spin three half, spin two, it depends on the lattice. If they reside on the frustration-free lattice, meaning without triangle, then any combination of that, if this lattice is big enough, then we believe that this is universal. So any question? Now that basically is my first part. So that's the summary. So these, because they are triangles, so we don't think that they're universal. But I'm move on to the next part. So this is a part that deals with the question of the parent Hamiltonian, whether there is a gap above the ground state. So I show you the 1D AQLT Hamiltonian. This is the two-dimensional honeycomb lattice model, which has one higher power of the Heisenberg interaction. But it actually comes from this projector. So they show that in the original paper that for the spin-spin correlation evaluated with respect to the ground state, it's actually bounded by an exponential decay correlation function. So size roughly 3 or 4 lattice size. So this strongly suggests there's non-zero gap. But unfortunately, exponential decay correlation doesn't imply the gap. The existence of gap implied the decay.
I would be a bit cautious with statements like that, right? There's models which have exponential decaying spin-spin correlations and critical Bamer-Dama correlations, right? So I think
so
to conclude from single correlation function of that, I think it's it's really reaching.
So that's just evidence. So, but this has been established. So I'm going to tell you the story how we get to showing that this is gap. So the inspiration that we got actually is from a paper earlier this year by Abdul Rahman and coworker, and they actually consider a decorated honeycomb lattice. So what they do is instead of the original AQLT and honeycomb, on each edge, they put a spin one particle, as many as possible. The reason spin one, because on a line, you always have two neighbors, so 2/2 is one, so spin one. And they consider this modified AQLT model, and they prove that with decoration 3 or more, this actually has a gap. This can be analytically shown as a gap. So this I regard as a first analytic proof of non-zero gap for some AQLT, two-dimensional. So this is, my view is really non-trivial result. So that's why get we interested back into this question. Somehow it freeze. Can I get a technical support from Microsoft? No, it's my computer, somehow it freeze. No, sometimes if I go back and then it will work.
One page.
Yeah, so but they still leave a question about declaration 201, because still have nothing to infer on the undecorated lattice. So let me describe the idea. So the idea is you would consider as modified Hamiltonian, and then you would square the Hamiltonian and look at how it related to the original Hamiltonian. But let me just describe this. If you don't get the detailed point, it's okay. But so they consider a modified Hamiltonian where it defined on YV. YV is this region. They consider the AKLT defined on this region, and they take all these overlapping regions and sum together. And you see that it's overlapping, so every bond is overlapping twice except the one that's connecting this to that. So therefore, you can have a bound that twice the AQLT is bigger than this Hamiltonian, but this Hamiltonian itself is bigger than the AQLT Hamiltonian. Bigger in the sense of you take the operator's difference, and that operator difference is non-negative. Or you can view another way, the AKLD Hamiltonian is upper bounded by this HY Hamiltonian and lower bounded by one half of that. But this Hamiltonian is not ideal because each local term is not a project, it's a sum of projectors. So essentially what they want to consider is you consider just a projector. Basically it's the range that projection to the range of this local Hamiltonian, this HD. So if you don't get the detail, it's fine. The upshot is that you can then use this modified projector Hamiltonian to bound the AKLT. So it's related to this. You basically take the worst case scenario. Worst case is the operator norm of the local HV, and you take the smallest non-zero eigenvalue as the lower bound here. So in the end, what you get is this bounding Hamiltonian. But at the moment, we care more about the lower bound. But if you don't get the detail here, it just you turn the problem into a lower bounding Hamiltonian that are sum of projectors in a bigger region. So and they prove that for n equal to 3 decoration or more is gap. So let me show slightly more detail of how we establish a non-zero gap. Is you square this. So you square this, and the diagonal turn give you back to the original Hamiltonian because of projectors. And then, but you have a non-diagonal turns. And so if those non-diagonal turns, they don't overlap, these are product of projectors, they are still positive. So if you drop these terms, you will get a lower bound on these. So you're left with those that are actually overlapping. So the hope, or maybe actually the wishful thinking, but it turns out it worked, is that if we can have an inequality like this, these anti-commutator of the two projector is not so negative, meaning that it's only small negative number times the sum of the projectors, then we might be able to continue this inequality, right? We might be able to continue. I think this, there should be a greater or equal sign here. And then you collect that back to your total Hamiltonian, and you're left with these epsilon times the coordination number, that how you divide the regions, yeah. So in the end, if this gamma is non-zero, then that shows that this Hamiltonian has a gap. And that means the original AKLT Hamiltonian, which is upper bound of this Hamiltonian, also has a gap. So I think this is a really cool idea. The question is whether this would work. So we want this to be greater than zero, or we want this epsilon to be smaller than one over the coordination number. Okay, so there's a nice lemma telling us actually this bound epsilon you can actually find from an operator norm of the product of the two projector and minus the E wedge F. The E wedge S is projection onto the range, joint range of two operator. We actually will not use this, but I will tell you the proof. In learning how we prove this, actually give some insight how we can actually compute this epsilon directly. Okay, so for the honeycomb case, yeah, so this is what they showed. What they did is actually the upper bound, they cannot compute this exactly, but the upper bound this quantity. If the upper bound is still small enough, then the gap can be established. And this is the case for n is 3 or greater. So we got very excited because this seems there is a way that this lemma actually can be useful in two dimension. So let me just describe. So the Hamiltonian, we remember Hamiltonian we define is on the projector on the range of this HV. But this lemma actually work if you take E to be the complement. So E F can be replaced by 1 minus E and 1 minus F, and the epsilon still remain the same. Okay, so this maybe I skip because they use a tensor network approach. They provide upper bound on this quantity. So let me just say in n equal to 1 case, this operator, so meaning that there's only one decoration, is about size of 12 qubits, so you can actually evaluate the number. Unfortunately, this number is larger than 1/3. In n equal to 2, they didn't provide any results. This we all estimate this is of the 20 qubit. It should be possible to do that. And for example, you look at n equal to 5, it's around 43, 44 qubit, but there's another proof. So we don't need to worry about large n. So our result, so we basically were inspired by their work. We tried to push this a little bit. So we actually first look at the decorated square lattice. And this is the local structure you need to consider. Right? So square lattice and some decoration. And we show that analytically, n equal to 4 or larger is actually has a gap. But we cannot say anything about n less than 4 analytically. But I want to comment that this way of proving, choosing this region only regards to local structure. So this applies actually to three dimension, any dimension that, for example, on a diamond lattice with decoration that you would also have gap. So what we then do is we try to reduce the complexity of the problem and see if we can actually do exact diagonalization. So this is the summary of that study. So we were able to actually reduce that. I will tell you the method we use to reduce the complexity of the problem. So this is from our numerical calculation after the reduction. You see that for a degree 3 honeycomb, n equal to 2 is still less than 1/3. And this is less than 1/4. And they're also like decorated triangular lattice. You can actually show that this is this number is small enough that we can actually claim that it's gap. But here it's not really analytic. We have to do some reductions and then solve by numerics. So I postpone the proof. Now I will discuss a little bit. How much time do I have?
9 minutes, including questions.
Okay, so I'll try to see. Okay, now, including questions. I will try to see if I can convey the main message here, and you could look up our paper or discuss with me afterwards. So the idea is we want to compute this number, epsilon, but actually when you dig deeper, actually there's a nice structure, geometric structure about that. And so, for example, if you look at the whole Hilbert space, and EH is the range of the action on any states in the Hilbert space, and F is the corresponding one by applying F. And they have some intersections. And you can actually show that somehow this happened again. You can actually find out more of the structure by considering the eigenvalue problem of this equation. So the sum of the projector define an eigenvalue problem. So we label the eigenvalue by 1 minus alpha. And because these are projectors, alpha range from minus 1 to 1. And if alpha is 1, for example, and this is 2, that means it satisfies the projectors, both of them. So it's in this joint intersection there. If alpha is 1, that means it's 0. That means that they're orthogonal. So this is in outside the region. And more importantly, if alpha is not minus 1 or 1, we can show that the gamma, the eigenvector can actually decompose into sum of the two vectors, which reside on, we call it VE here, and then VF here. So they live in disjoint subspace. And there's a nice relation that the action of F on the component in VE actually map to 1 that's in VF. So there's some kind of duality, I don't know what.
I think that's exactly the proof of this two-dimensional decomposition.
Okay. So then, because of this relation, you can actually write down the action of the commutator on the eigenvector. You see that it's actually minus alpha times 1 minus alpha. So there's a nice relation between the eigenvector of the two operator. So for the plus and minus 1, so if it's plus 1, this left-hand side is 0, right-hand side is 0. So it does not give you any more constraint. If it's minus 1, they are nicely in joint subspace, so they're all positive.
Are E and F, please remind me, they're projectors.
Yeah, E and F, now I consider general projectors. They have to be projectors, yeah.
Okay, so these are like the Jordan canonical angle between the two. Right?
Yeah, you can say, yeah. So now we have that, you can actually see that because they live in space like this. So this term actually has no contribution. And then you can prove that this epsilon of this is actually the maximum non-integer value of the spectrum of that equation. So that's why we were able, I haven't told you. We then use the structure of the tensor network of the underlying ground space. I think that's essential. If we don't know the underlying ground space, it's difficult for us to construct the projectors to the ground space, local ground space, and then we will not be able to reduce the complexity of this eigenvalue problem. So this is the problem we want to reduce. So this E and F, it can be very large. But we want to reduce that eigenvalue equations. So let me give you a picture. So let me just use picture. So basically, the idea is that if you consider this region and the three region, you can actually decompose using tensor network construction. These are physical indices and they are virtual indices. If the virtual indices have fewer dimension than the physical indices, then you can actually reduce that prior eigenvalue equation. So that's the essential point. But I don't want to go to the detail here. So the tool is that we use SVD. So if you do SVD, meaning that this physical index can be truncated into really smaller dimension. So that's the essence of the method. So, and we show that this maximal eigenvalue is preserved. So that then that this give you the numerical procedure. You use SVD to find out what is the isometry that you have to do, and then you apply to the E and F. Then you can reduce the dimension. So I've been very quick here. And then if we diagonalize these reduced eigenvalue problem, we want to find the smallest eigenvalue because we want a maximum alpha, but this is smaller. And if this is smaller than 1 over the coordination number, then the model is gapped. So conceptually, that's the way we proceed. Just to give you some number, on the decorated lattices, Z is the coordination number. The physical space is this, but E prime, F prime, you can reduce. If you reduce this here and there, it's reduced to here, but because the middle region also has a tensor network structure, it actually has tensor network structure everywhere, so you can actually reduce to a dimension like this. So in terms of honeycomb, it's 3 plus 3 plus 2, so it's actually 8 qubits. So we can actually reduce, it's always 8 qubits that we can easily diagonalize the 2 to the A by 2 to the A matrix. So let me now talk about, because once you have that, you can find the smallest gap of the local AKLT Hamiltonian region, you can bound the gap. But let me not dwell too much. So the second main result is on these singly decorated lattice. So this is the main open question from the previous study on the decorated lattice. Now I think it's clear we want to find some region divide the space into overlapping regions so that we get the eta or the epsilon small enough. So this involves some trial and error because we don't have a really good guidance to find these divisions. But this is what we found. So if you consider the red and the blue, and I'm just showing the essential overlapping. So this is one, that's the other. So our intuition is that remember from the left to the right part, we like to have a separation of one edge in between. We need a separation big enough. This is the intuition from the decoration two, because we can show decoration two still work. So that's the intuition. We want to find regions so that when you consider the two nearby overlapping region, in order from one to go to the other, you need to hop 1, 2, 3 to the other. So based on this, so we find example like this, and we're actually able to show that in the case of singly decorated, these epsilons are smaller than the new coordination numbers, not necessarily the same coordination number as the original lattice because we do some grouping. These are the reduced dimensions, and gamma is the low, gamma is this 1 minus coordination times epsilon. Delta is the lower bounding gap value. So when it comes to the original AKLT, we did a lot of trial and error because the choice is there's more way to choose that partitions, but we come up with this. So this is one region, and that's the neighboring region. So we need to partition so that all the edges has been covered at least once. So basically, you need to find sufficient large region and overlapping. And for this honeycomb lattice, we're able to show that this epsilon is smaller than 1/6. The dimension is big enough, we can actually do the E exact diagonalization, but we have to use Lanczos. So that's the approximation we have to do. And so we found the gap is small, really small, 0.004. Our previous tensor network study in infinite two dimension shows that the gap of honeycomb is about 0.1. So this lower bound is really loose. So this lower bound on the honeycomb. But other lattice, like square, octagon, star, I think we had the number here. Forgot to put it here. The cross is probably bigger. And I think the star actually has the largest. Somehow I just didn't put it here. Okay. So I guess that brings me closer to the end. Technical support again. So I want to mention that there is another work by Lin, Sandvik, and Wang. They use a slightly different approach, but basically the idea is similar. You square the Hamiltonian and see how you can massage the right-hand side. And so what they show is that if you can show that this finite size problem, the alpha is the way they put in to the original local Hamiltonian, if they can show that this finite size problem has a gap greater than this number, then for any bigger system size than this periodic boundary condition, then you can show that AQLT is gap. So to solve this, they use DMRG method with SU2 symmetry. And because you see that there are 12 dangling bonds. And so, is it 12? 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Yeah, 12. So it's hard to count in front of a lot of people, you know. So the excitation you can have is to break a bound. When you break a bound, the angular momentum can be bigger than 12. And they show that actually the smallest one occur at the sector total angular momentum is 13. And this is happily bigger than this. So the gap is established in the honeycomb lattice. So probably
over time.
Okay. So let me just skip the discussion of the frustration. If somebody wants to ask, I can discuss that. Since this is a phase of matter, I want to show a phase diagram. You could also consider deformation. And actually, Steve and student were the first to consider such a deformation that the quantum computation is still possible. But we could also consider deformation around the AQLT point in the square lattice case. So let me summarize. So I discussed how we can use AQLT family of state for universal measurement-based quantum computation. I discussed how to establish non-zero gap for a certain AQLT model on two dimensions. So these are open problems that I would like to look into more. So for example, can we actually prove that AQLT states with higher spin are universal? And maybe what is the essential symmetry that stabilizes, for example, the phase diagram that I show you, and more general AQLT phase? And can the entire phase be universal resource? That would be a nice thing to establish. And also proving the non-zero gap for the square lattice. So thank you very much.
Questions? So I have a question about getting this ED method closer to, say, a computer-assisted proof. Because, say you're looking for some lowest eigenvalue of a matrix.
Nice.
ED will give you an upper bound, right? Basically, because it will give you a subspace or a vector, and this
right.
Obviously gives you a variation upper bound on the smallest eigenvalue. But you would like to have a lower bound for this kind of argument. Do you know of any method to kind of, or does anyone else know of any method to get a lower bound on the smallest eigenvalue?
That's a very good question. Yes. So what we do in the case that we can use ED, this is indicated by method one, is that we can count how much we reduce by the SBD.
Mm-hmm.
And when you do the eigenvalue solver, you solve, right? You can verify its eigenvectors by just evaluating.
But it's not the same problem, right? That you only get upper bounds for.
You can bound the error by computing the variance of the Hamiltonian.
No, this only bounds the distance to an eigenstate, right? It doesn't bound the distance to the lowest eigenstate.
So as I said, we can count how many eigenvalue we have obtained. Yeah.
In total. But if you have 2 to the 26, so you will not get all of them, right? Full diagonalization is fine. I'm completely happy with full diagonalization,
mm-hmm.
full matrix.
Right.
Imagine it's dimension 2 to the 26.
Yeah, so
and
we...
then you will just compute the leading ones.
We have other method to double check that. But of course, we cannot...
No, that's not my question. My question is, can you give a certificate where you can be provably sure that this certificate, which you indeed have to check with a computer because it's too big, will actually validate that fact?
You can,
the lowest eigenvalue is not below a certain value.
Right, so if you have a local Hamiltonian, you can construct patches that may not be globally consistent.
Well, that's a different problem, it's not local Hamiltonian, right? So you have a big matrix which you never actually build.
Well, I don't know.
Where you just know how to apply it as a linear map, and you want to know if you can provide a certificate which lower bounds the smallest eigenvalue.
Yeah, I don't know.
I think
that's a good question.
It puts it in computer based, but then you could call it a computer based proof, right? Because you could actually say, look, on this USB stick, there is a proof for that.
But then it's still sparse, right?
Maybe
the matrix from the Hamiltonian, which is.
After the SVD, we don't know whether it's sparse enough. Yeah. But before SVD, it's sparse.
I think the E and the F are not really sparse anymore. They just act on kind of their stuff, times identity, and vice versa, right? Acting on some overlapping on some region. And you want to solve some eigenvalue problem with these guys. At least in all cases, I know you want the other bound, not the bound you get by lunch, but the lower bound.
So the certificate we can probably provide would be eigenvalue and eigenvectors for all of them, if you have enough space.
If you have all, you're fine, right? My question is really in that case where you're 2 to
26. For the using the Lentzschler, then. So the SVD already project out some of the irrelevant eigenvectors. And then we have other method we can shift the range we want to probe the eigenvalue. I know it's not satisfactory because all the numerical method always have some flaw you can.
No, but I think it's two different questions,
no.
In my opinion.
It's a very interesting question. I don't know.
One could argue it's a complex problem. Maybe find the lowest eigenvector, there should be a dual and it should give you.
Yeah, if there's a dual problem, then one can.
There should be one, probably.
I don't know the answer.
Anyone have the
good discussion for the coffee break?
Exactly.
Is there any other questions?
When some graphs become universal and others cross that formula base.
When
some graphs.
What kind of graph?
You said
random. You mean random graph?
You some graphs become universal and some not.
Yeah.
Is there really no intuition or log based distribution?
The intuition is that if we can if I am able to apply these projectors. Even in the spin 2 generalization, if I can say I just mathematically apply these fixed, then I know it's universal, because I can. But these only occur with small probability. So, but that gives you some intuition that it's possible with non-zero probability that you might be able to fish out from these random outcomes. There are some instances of the measurement outcome that you should be able to get a regular graph. Steve also have looked at this approach to prove the interpolation between the cluster Hamiltonian and the chaotic Hamiltonian, the gap. Yeah. So maybe an easy answer is I don't have really much deeper intuition, but over the course of study of these we found that as long as it's not frustrated, then we don't encounter any any problem, at least for spin two or less than that. But for higher spin two, we have the technical issue of making these generalized measurements to be complete by themselves without leaking to other logical space. So I don't have anything I can say about higher spin. But for small spin, we know that if it's not frustrated, then we can do that. And frustration is not really that serious. If it's a pentagon, bigger loop, then it's okay. But it's just the local triangle is making you a lot of problems. Or maybe I can show that triangle. Okay, maybe just show you. So if you stare at this, this is an example from the measurement, but that has triangles on these lattices. If you stare, this looks disjoint. So these are the graphs that are disjoint. So if you have these, then the way we construct the measurement to filter out graph state is not good enough. So there may be other way you can bypass this, but we don't.
I think we better thank Suchi again.
Thank you.